there's this veneer of media objectivity where it's like nothing to see here, don't worry about it, we're objective. And then the ownership structure has completely changed. You have the more successful national media organizations that have become polarized because of audience share generally. Like if you decide to become a little more partisan, then you can actually get a more consistent audience.
What's partly so frustrating is, in addition to the bias that it exists, but that there's a certain invisibility to the bias among mainstream corporate outlets, right? So I will often hear people say, if I tweet out an Intercept article, oh gosh, that's your source for saying X, Y, and Z, I'm not gonna believe it, which is kind of the opposite of what you should be thinking.
Happy holidays and Merry Christmas for those who celebrate. From the Yang Speaks family, this is Zach Rauman, one of the co-hosts of this podcast with Andrew, welcoming you to a special holiday episode of Yang Speaks. I hope you guys have all had some time to relax and enjoy. It's been a crazy slash rough year, and hopefully you've been able to relax, watch some movies, drink some eggnog, if you like eggnog. I don't, but I guess people do. But hope you enjoy your holiday. Look, we've got a special episode today. Brianna Joy Gray is joining with Andrew. Brianna was the national press secretary for Bernie Sanders in 2020. She's also a former member of the media, having worked as an editor for Current Affairs and a senior politics editor for The Intercept. So she's got this interesting perspective of running for office in politics, but also in the media. The one thing I will say before you guys dive in is that I've seen a lot of comments on Twitter, depending who we bring on the episode, it's like, oh, you bring these people on the right, or you bring these people on the left, I don't like it. And look, that's fine, you're welcome to your opinion, but I just want you to know, we do believe in humanity first. We also don't believe that if you bring someone on your podcast, you have to agree with everything they say. We've had conservatives, and we've had far-left liberals on Yang Speaks, and Andrew's gone on their podcast as well. And I wanted to share with you over the holidays that a friendly reminder that we're all humans. We are human beings first, and there's a lot more that we share than there is that we disagree about. So with that, I hope you guys enjoy this episode with Brianna. I wish you all a very, very happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate. This is a time of year where we get to pause, relax, and reflect on who we love and what's special about all of us as humans. So love you guys. Enjoy this episode of Yang Speaks.
I am so pumped to be sitting down with Bernie Sanders, National Press Secretary, powerhouse extraordinaire, Brianna Gray. Welcome, Brie. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you. Is it okay if I call you Brie? Is that the your?
Yeah, of course. I made my Twitter handle back in 2009 because I was working somewhere where they wanted me to do it. They wanted me to make a Twitter account and teach them how Twitter worked because I was like the young person on the staff. And so I made it Brie Brie Joy, not really thinking anything of it. And now, you know, over a decade later, everyone calls me Brie. But it's cool. It feels familiar and comfortable and nice. So I like it.
It is very familiar. I can relate to your Twitter evolution. So I'm a little bit older than you, which means that that my Twitter indoctrination happened a little bit later in life. So for me, what happened was I wrote a book in 2014 and the publisher was like, hey, you need to be on Twitter. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'll get on Twitter now. So it was like 2013. I like having a social media account for various platforms, but I haven't been very active. And then when I decided to run for president, then it became a much bigger deal. So it sounds like it was similar for you, where 10 years ago you created this account just to have it, and then it became this enormous deal when you became this public figure.
Yeah, I didn't use it at all until 2015, 2016, because I was, you know, big mad online about progressive issues not getting the hearing that I thought they should in the context of the Bernie campaign. So to the extent that anyone's ever mad at me for being too online, you can blame Bernie Sanders.
Being too online is a real problem because there are so many times I wind up in like an online rabbit hole or vortex, and I'm just like, what am I doing? Like, this is not what I should be doing with my fine, whatever day of the week it is. So I would love to hear about your path and your evolution, because I feel like everyone would want to be you in multiple ways. But you're this leading progressive voice. There are so many people that, in my view, are aligned with you, believe what you believe. I think you would do a fantastic job of arguing for your point of view and doing it in a way that's very positive and effective. So can you share a little bit of your arc, sort of how you arrived at this juncture?
Yeah. So I, like a lot of young people, wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. I graduated in 2007. I was a history of science, history of art and architecture major, so no clear career path there. I was one of these people who thought, well, I'm a good writer. I like to argue. Everyone's been telling me I should be a lawyer, so let me go ahead and apply to law school. And, you know, after law school, I still wasn't entirely clear what I wanted to do. So I, you know, just went to work for a firm and figured I can, you know, use the money to pay off my loans and then have the flexibility to take any kind of perhaps more creative writing job that I really would like to do without the, you know, enormous six-figure student loan debt on my shoulders. But like a lot of people in my age cohort, we got hit really hard by the recession. And kind of the bonuses and job opportunities that I thought were going to materialize didn't. I started at my firm in... Well, I graduated law school in 2011 and should have started, you know, that fall, but a lot of us were deferred, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I ended up working as a lawyer for about 7 years, struggling to pay down my debt. But when 2015 happened and 2016 happened and Bernie Sanders was running, I found myself really frustrated by a lot of the media narratives that were going around, in particular, the idea that he didn't have any diverse support. The reality was, even back then, that the majority of people under 30 of every demographic group and across the gender spectrum preferred Bernie Sanders. I was 31 at the time, but I like to lump myself into that crowd.
We'll give it to you for sure, Bree. No probs.
I'm a little ahead of my time generationally. So I started tweeting a lot. And my, you know, 100 follower account started to grow. And eventually I started a podcast called Someone's Wrong on the Internet, because I was so frustrated with the narratives that were going around. And I started it with a friend of mine who's both gay and Korean American, because of all of the narrative that was only white people support Bernie Sanders. And I said, well, let me start writing articles to draw attention to this podcast.
Wait. Where do you think that narrative originated? Like, was there a particular media outlet that decided to throw that out there?
There was an initial article. I forget where it was. I want to say, let me not guess. I want to say Politico, but that just might be my own bias that has emerged over a series of kind of bias political takes from that particular outlet. But the person who wrote the article later said that they thought it had been taken too far and kind of regrets the trend. But I think it was something that was going to emerge no matter what. I don't know if you remember from the leaked Podesta emails, from the Hillary Clinton emails, one of the exchanges that you saw was an email from Neera Tanden, who's now part of Joe Biden's staff, saying, we've got to get all of these journalists of color, and there was a list of journalists, to really push this, to talk about the fact that Bernie has a Bernie bro problem, that they could be helpful in this regard. So it really was a top-down approach to say, let's exploit the fact that Democrats care about people of color, they care about diversity as one of the main things that distinguishes the party from Republicans, and try to pitch Bernie's movement as somehow uninclusive, anti-inclusivity, when it was never really the case. And then in 2020, I think we all saw that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden were the only people who managed to really get above double digits with respect to Black voters. Bernie Sanders was number one with Latino voters. And Bernie Sanders was even number one with Black voters for a period of time there in February. But you never really heard that in the mainstream media, and the narrative persisted despite the fact that, you know, Bernie raised more money from Black voters than had ever given to a political campaign in history. More Black voters contributed to Bernie's campaign than any other campaign. It's so, it was frustrating.
I can understand that, because Bernie 2015 was such a pure messenger that I can see a lot of folks of any, certainly any racial background, getting behind it, because, like, yeah, I remember watching Bernie speak and being like, yeah, every word he said was right. I was like, yep, that's right. And somewhere around there, I, you know, sent him you know, donation, because I was like, well, if I think he's right, then I should get behind him. So I know people, a lot of people felt that way. So what it sounds like you're suggesting is that there was a Politico article, and then some folks who supported Hillary Clinton were like, ooh, let's make some hay out of that. And they decided to like push it to the moon.
I'm not sure if they, you know, they, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg. I don't remember the timeline at this point. And remember, I was just a civilian. I was not involved in politics at all at this point.
What happened, Bree? You've gotten absorbed.
Well, what happened was I started writing articles in order to draw attention to the podcast, and the articles themselves really took off. And I started freelancing, and I would stay late at the law firm and write until midnight, you know, and, you know, or, you know, write during my lunch break and stay till midnight trying to make up for the work that I should have been doing.
One or the other. I understand.
And eventually that manifested in an offer from The Intercept to come on as a senior politics editor at the start of 2018. Which was a dream come
true. For a massive pay cut of approximately 75%.
It was a significant pay cut. I will say my erstwhile financial advisor would not have advised me to do that. But it was literally my dream come true. And I had enough savings, and this is, you know, my relative privilege that enabled me to do this. I had enough savings to basically take the pay cut and eat through my savings for a year while working at The Intercept. And right as I had to make some decisions about, you know, whether to move and, you know, how to make this work and how to refinance my loans or whatever I needed to do, I was reached out to by the Bernie campaign in the beginning of 2019 about whether or not I wanted to come on board as national press secretary. And that didn't resolve my financial problems, but it didn't mean that I would move to DC. I had to move anyway. I had to get a two-room apartment anyway. And it was, you know, an opportunity that I thought long and hard about. Right? Because I enjoyed my independence at The Intercept. I understood how identity was going to be weaponized in 2020 again. And I thought there was some benefit to having an independent journalist of color who's a woman.
That's true.
You know, not
you were doing good from where you were. And then you know, uh-oh, she has gone political. So it sounds like you were a full-time journalist for a little more than a year. Is that right?
A little less than a year. Yeah.
So was that the dream come true? Was that wonderful, that period of time?
I loved it. I loved working at The Intercept. I loved working at a place where my politics were validated and my insights were really encouraged. You know, I had friends at my law firm and I really appreciated my experiences there as well, but
they're all miserable. I'm kidding.
You know how it is. Look, the 2016 really exposed the extent to which we had very different political priorities, and people who I thought, you know, I was in New York. We all were, you know, capital L liberal. I thought we all basically.
Where did you grow up, Bree? I'm sorry. I should know this. Like, were you a New York area product originally or no?
Yes and no. That's a little bit of a complicated story. I moved to New York when I was 15. But I graduated from high school in New York, but we had been living abroad for 8 years before that.
Abroad where?
We were in Saudi Arabia for 2 years and in Kenya for 6 years.
Wow. It's so cosmopolitan. You showed up in New York at age 15.
Yeah, at age 15. And before that, we had been living in North Carolina. My mom was in her doctoral program at NC State. And we lived there for 6 years in my youth. But I was born in Washington, D.C., where my parents met because they both went to Howard University.
Wow. Okay. Sorry. Thank you for that arc. That was very helpful to me. So if you went to high school in New York and then you worked there for 8 years, I mean, you were very, very New York. So then you moved to DC for the Bernie campaign. How was that? Yeah.
You know, there's a lot to love about DC. Mostly I didn't get to experience it that much because I was so just involved in campaign life. And, you know, traveling a good amount of time. It wasn't as though I was kind of meandering around the city and exploring the way I would like to. Frankly, since COVID.
You weren't just doing the DC food tour.
Right. In the last year, obviously, it's been COVID. But since COVID, I've actually been able to walk around my neighborhood more, get a better sense of the layout of the city. And I feel like I know it a lot better than I did when I was, you know, working during the campaign season.
I'm a huge fan of The Intercept's journalism. Everything I've seen out of there just seemed so real and on point, is different than other outlets that way. And I think there's like a major problem
with what some people call corporate media.
I am one of those people.
Oh no! I mean, heck, like I like that as a moniker. It makes you think. You're like, yeah, corporate media, and then you're like, what's the opposite of corporate media? So I think the massive crisis in journalism. You know, the first thing, it's like a layer cake, and it's all terrible. But the first layer is that over 2,000 local papers have gone out of business. And so if you're in a community, it's like no local news. Like, how the heck can you vote on anything that's going on in your community? And then you have the national media, which is completely polarized in various directions because your economic incentives drive you that way. And then you have the social media layer on top of it that just drives you even more to extremity, even into like different versions of reality, where at this point it's like, you know, up is down, left is right, you know, like vote totals are whatever we say they are.
Yeah, well, I have mixed feelings about the social media piece, but to your point about the independent media versus corporate media piece, you know, there's a legitimate criticism that can be made about the Intercept's funding model as well, but there's a big difference when you have to the incentive structure when you're working at a place like The Intercept, where you don't have requirements to get a certain number of clicks or publish a certain number of articles a day. You can spend time doing research and reporting without the kind of financial pressures of the typical ad revenue model, because it's funded by, you know, a billionaire. There's like a large amount of money that's guaranteed to The Intercept to do its work, regardless of how much money it makes. Whereas other outlets tend to have to make sure that
this is one of the billionaires, right?
Well, you know, that's what when I say that there's a legitimate criticism, legitimate critique to be made of the Intercept study model. There are pros and cons of that, obviously, but there are firewalls up between the Intercept and the eBay billionaire, who's the one that funds the Intercept. And there are a lot of
on the record. I am a fan of Omidyar. I think Pierre Omidyar has done so much good work, not just The Intercept, but I ran a nonprofit for years, and the Omidyar Social Fellows and the social innovation investments he's made. I think the fact that he already saw the problems with journalism and was trying to do something about it early on, that there are legitimate criticisms of our winner-take-all economic system, but in my mind, Omidyar is among the most benevolent wealthy people out there.
Yeah, I think, look, the point is not ever, in the critiques that come from the left about the massive accumulation of wealth, et cetera, is not to say that any one individual is, you know, evil, or that, you know, there aren't people who can do good things with their wealth. The idea, you know, do you say winner take all? Obviously, Anand Giridharadas wrote this great book about this idea. The idea is we shouldn't have to rely on private charity to fix the problems of the world, and that the enormous accumulation of wealth in the hands of very few people can have really stymieing effects for journalism, the fourth estate, our democracy, you know, the ability of someone like, you know, Michael Bloomberg, who was the ninth richest person on the planet to enter the race. What that means is that, you know, he has the money to fund his famed mayor school, right? Where so many people were arguably willing to endorse him, and particularly a lot of black mayors.
It did seem like a lot of mayors came out for like Bloomberg, and you're like, oh, maybe there's something going on there.
Yeah, and it's not again that the mayors are bad people or like, you know, wanting to do a bad thing. But if you go through his mayor's program,
I had nothing
you've been
against
funded.
It. For the record, if I were mayor of a city and Mike Bloomberg had funded something in my city and then decided to do something, you know, like I'm not mad at anyone who said, look, the best thing for my community is for me to get on board with this campaign.
Well, here's the thing. It's one thing to critique the system. The system is that a lot of mayors, particularly these black mayors from poorer districts, right, who are from predominantly minority districts, who have a harder time raising money. Same goes for disproportionately black Congress people, right, who are similarly coming from districts where it's harder to earn money because they have a lower income population, for all the historical reasons that we understand, you know, tend to be more susceptible to these kinds of buyouts. And that's not because they're worse people. It's because of these structural issues in terms of their inability to raise funds. And the fact that especially when you're a congressperson, your number one job is to raise funds for the party. And there's enormous pressures on you to get that money. So the critique is not to say, you know, Keisha Lance Bottoms is a problem. It's to say, what can we do to make it so that Keisha Lance Bottoms is more free to vote her conscience, to reflect the interest of the people that she presides over, her constituents, instead of feeling the need to take this money and then to give an endorsement.
I don't remember. I thought Keisha Lance Bottoms was for Joe, but there was like a, there were a number of other young black mayors that,
there
that
were.
Fell into
sorry,
this camp.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to like throw her in particular under the bus, but she was the first Southern black mayor
black
that
mayor that came to mind. She is very cool. You know, I spent a lot of time in Atlanta of late. So one of the things that people I don't think make enough of, Bree, is that at this point, vast wealth, often technology wealth, and the media have now converged, where you have these legacy media properties that can't make money or can't make enough money to keep people happy. And so then some tech mogul titan who does not like sports as much decides to buy the publication. So Mark Benioff buys Time Magazine. Jeff Bezos buys the Washington Post. Laureen Powell Jobs buys the Atlantic. Now, some of these people I like, you know, like some of them I like less. You know, but there's definitely a thing where tech money, and I guess you could use The Intercept as an example, though we didn't buy it. It's not like a legacy media property that that Omidyar decided to buy. But there has been this convergence, and I don't know if people, this is something that I actually am very, very frustrated by, is that there's this veneer of media objectivity, where it's like nothing to see here, don't worry about it, we're objective. And then the ownership structure has completely changed. There was a point when you had these firms that were very profitable firms, you know, newspapers even, great business for generations. And then that business has gotten decimated. So now you have 2,000 local papers out of existence. Over half of the papers that still exist are owned by private equity. So they're just like ringing them for cash and they don't really care about the local coverage so much. And then you have the legacy publications that have often gotten consolidated or bought up by their individuals or private equity or other firms. And then you have the more successful national media organizations that have become polarized because of audience share generally. Like if you decide to become a little more partisan, then you can actually get a more consistent audience.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate diagnosis. And to one of your first points, what's partly so frustrating is, in addition to the bias in that it exists, but that there's a certain invisibility to the bias among mainstream corporate outlets, right? So I will often hear people say, if I tweet out an Intercept article, oh gosh, that's your source for saying X, Y, and Z, I'm not going to believe it, which is kind of the opposite of what you should be thinking. You should trust a relatively more independent outlet over, you know, frankly, the New York Times. I mean, I know that it sounds, people might be tired of hearing about Bernie Bros and media bias. And I understand that. But I'll tell you, working on the comm side and the campaign.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that's true. You have all the inside scoop. What the heck was going on over there?
You know, the conversations that I was having with people in an effort to just say what had happened, right? So there was an episode where I was on the road, Bernie Sanders and all of the candidates, I think almost everybody, maybe you were there, Andrew, I can't quite remember, had spoken at, I believe it was an NAACP conference in Detroit. And everybody spoke, but Bernie Sanders was the only candidate to get a standing ovation from the room. And when I read the New York Times write-up of the event, the words Bernie or Sanders were not mentioned once in this article. At the time, Bernie was the number two candidate in the polls, right? So I reached out to the author.
This and must
I
said, have driven you insane.
Right. Especially given all of the narrative around Bernie having a black problem, right? He's the only one at an NAACP conference who gets a standing ovation from the room. So I reached out to the writer who I had recently met at Netroots, and I thought we had a lovely talk. And I said, hey, I just wanted to, you know, reach out and ask about why it was that Bernie wasn't mentioned, especially since he did so well and because he is literally the number two candidate in this race.
And it's a black audience.
Right. And he said, oh, I must have been in the bathroom when that happened.
No way.
So I said, oh, okay. Well, the footage went up immediately after. You know, you could have watched it.
I can send
back.
It to you. You can watch your bathroom break. But this is like a football game where you have TiVo.
Right. And you know, if you were going to time a bathroom break, I perhaps would have timed it not during the number two candidate in the race's remarks, but
you can wait till Yang.
Well, yeah, we all know that you were a dark horse and people were sleeping on you for too long. But you know, oh, that's nice then of you. you know what, you know, I think it's true, but you know, his response at that point was, you know, not good and relatively hostile. And he pivoted to some other concerns. He thought, you know, he thought that the campaign had unfairly beat up on one of his colleagues because she had written a piece that had gotten a lot of criticism, not from us, but from the public, because it was not a great piece. And I was like, well, this isn't really my issue. And then the conversation devolved. But that kind of thing happened again and again. There was another time a journalist had written that Bernie was not going to make the debate after the heart attack, that he was going to miss the next debate after the heart attack. It was said declaratively like that. And so I reached out and said, okay, well, all the doctors are saying this kind of procedure that he had usually has a 4-day recovery window. And people are back out on the golf course or whatever. And would you mind changing that? And he said, no, absolutely not. I said, on what basis, you know, this person has a doctor in front of their name, but they're not a medical doctor. I said, your writer, he was an editor, your writer should not be quoting you as a source of medical expertise as to when Bernie Sanders can attend a debate. And of course, he was at the debate, right? So it was this kind of thing over and over and over again. You know, Bernie wins Nevada and Chris Matthews is talking about how people are going to be, you know, chopping heads off in Central Park. Bernie supporters are going to be chopping people's heads off in Central Park. There's no mention of the fact that he got 70% of the Latino vote and how important the Latino vote was going to be in the general election, right? You had a person bringing a Nazi flag to a Bernie rally and it getting no coverage. But, you know, the use of some snake emojis under other candidates, you know, Instagram pages being a 45-minute interview subject for Rachel Maddow, you know, and on and on and on. And important things were happening, right? The country was going into a crisis toward the end of the primary. Bernie Sanders was standing there with a lot of the answers. And, you know, as someone who's been championing universal basic income, we needed big ticket ideas to get us out of this crisis, which we all saw coming down the pike by the end of the primary season. And right now we are struggling. We have gotten this stimulus package now that is half of what was being offered up prior to the election. And none of the substantive structural changes that were on offer managed to make it through the primary season. And it's demoralizing to have seen such promise and inspiring ideas from people like you, people like Bernie, people like Elizabeth Warren, and to see none of that really reflected in our party at present.
Your experiences on the Bernie campaign with the media are reflective. And so I want to dig into this more because, and I also don't want to be like, oh, you know, like that, like media, this and that. But hearing your perspective is fascinating.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
So when you talk about corporate media, sometimes it brings to mind for me, it's like, okay, what is the uncorporate media? Like, what is a source that you can actually just shrug and say they don't have any incentives around suppressing one candidate or elevating another? One outlet that people do trust more than others is NPR, which is publicly funded. You also have C-SPAN, which is the most boring thing in the world, but it literally just, but it just like sticks a camera on people and just like lets them work. So I had a story, like a time when I was in a hotel in Iowa after a day of campaigning, and then I turned on TV and I was just flipping channels, and then I saw C-SPAN, I saw myself, and I was like, like, what's this? And it was an event I'd done that day, and it was just presented without commentary. It was just me hanging out with high school kids answering questions. And I was like, wow, this is up at C-SPAN. Very, very different than the cable news coverage, which has a completely different rhythm and presentation style. So if we were to want to mend journalism, like, do you have any ideas? Like, I think that there should be much more public investment in journalism. I do not see any other way, because right now you have the corporate incentives going one direction. And then in my mind, it's either philanthropy or public resources. Those are really the only two. And the tech version is philanthropy, essentially, because if you look at the wealth and the people who care about this, it ends up being techies very often. And so if you don't love that, and they, you know, there are ups and downs to it, like I you know, I think some of them do a great job. I'm a fan of The Atlantic's work. Like, you know, I love The Atlantic. I think Intercept is great work. But then you pretty quickly land on public support for journalism. And then there are a lot of folks that are like, oh, you can't have the government fund journalism because, like, you know, it'll be corrupt, Orwellian, Big Brother, like, you know, they'll like censor everything and the rest of it. And you're like, well, there is like the BBC, which is publicly funded, and they seem okay. You have NPR, seems okay. You have, you know, different examples of this throughout the world.
Yeah. So the conversation about kind of government versus private funding is the same conversation that ends up happening about between Republicans and Democrats about big government versus small government, right? And what is missing from that conversation often is like, sure, hypothetically, the government could be corrupt. But we all know that there's an enormous amount of corruption in the business world, and there are no democratic mechanisms for us to do anything about that. So at least when we have government, we have some semblance of democracy still, and we can vote people in and out and have an accountability mechanism. Nobody really talks about, okay, we have the free market. How are we going to hold Jeff Bezos, who's richer than God, accountable for anything that he does to any of his employees, et cetera? But there's a third option, right? There is independently subscriber-funded media that's neither government or business-based. And that's where you have outlets like Current Affairs, where I'm a contributing editor. You have outlets like The Intercept is partially independently funded. They are trying increasingly to get off of Pierce funding. And when people subscribe, it helps them to be able to do that. You have outlets like David Sirota, who was my colleague on the campaign, but a veteran journalist of 20 years before that, who started his own blog, The Daily Poster. You have a lot of people abdicate, defecting from their journalistic institution. Glenn Greenwald recently left The Intercept to start his own blog that is independently funded on Patreon, where people give money to these to these individuals. Or in David Sirota's case, he's trying to start not just an individual platform, but a platform where a lot of progressive journalists can come and write about corruption and the other kinds of issues that get very little hearing in the mainstream media, but are really at the root of a lot of the problems in this country, through his outlet called The Daily Poster. So I do think that people are finding a lot of interest in this, and it's a sustainable model to a certain degree. But if we are ever going to be able to compete with the MSNBCs and CNNs and Fox News of the world, I agree that something more substantial has to change. And I think viewers demanding more of those corporate institutions would be really helpful, because currently, I think the average American believes that that reporting out of quote-unquote liberal institutions, liberal media institutions, is being done in good faith. And they don't know that so many of, like, MSNBC newscasters, pundits, are conservative. They don't even know that some of the people who are giving advice to the Democratic Party on a daily basis, you know, George Bush's former comms woman has a primetime spot at MSNBC. You know, Fair Vote and other organizations that have assessed media bias show that the average MSNBC panel is skewed more conservative, has more Republicans on it than the average Fox News panel. You know, and so people are digesting this information in good faith, not even really realizing that the institutions that they think are liberal and have a liberal bias and that they want a liberal bias aren't even liberal. They are echoing the same kinds of right-wing talking points that you get on Fox News. And in fact, due to this kind of weird populist surge that's happening on the right, sometimes you get a Fox News pundit who's more willing to talk honestly about something like trade policies or healthcare even than some of the MSNBC hosts.
There are two things I'd like to suggest here. One is it's not left or right anymore. It's kind of in the institution or outside the institution. And I love the folks like you who are like trying to like create the outside of the institution ecosystem and voices. The second thing is that I love the subscriber model that you and others, and just to be like, I don't know whether this is true, you're working at Current Affairs as an editor. Are you now at a point where you're generating subscription for yourself personally, or like, are you working for a publication?
So I don't get paid by Current Affairs. I'm kind of there as a an advisory role as a contributing editor and stuff like that. My income comes through my podcast, Bad Faith. So, you know, my co-host Virgil Texas and I, and he's from Chapo Trap House.
Check out Bad Faith. It's a great podcast. I've been there.
Yes, you have. It's a great episode.
It is worth your time and donation. Don't you want to support Bree and Virgil?
I appreciate that, Andrew. But yeah, we, you know, the subscriber model has worked. You know, for a relatively small sum of money each month, people can unlock, you know, a ton of premium episodes. Plus, we put out a free episode every week. And they get a lens on the news that they wouldn't otherwise get. Now, everyone, you know, doesn't work as well for everyone. Obviously, we're advantaged by the fact that we had, you know, platforms. People knew who we are.
You're like national voices and whatnot. This is one of the things that too, Bree, like I struggle with too, because, you know, you to yourself, you're you. But you are remarkable. Virgil is very, very well known. And the fact that you can make it work does not mean that, you know, like the bottom, whatever, 90 some odd percent of folks could make it work in the same way.
That's true. But take this into account. When I was a completely anonymous citizen with 200 Twitter followers, I started a podcast. And over the course of 2 years, we got to about, I don't know, 8,000 people listening to the podcast on average every 2 weeks, actually. And that puts you in like the top echelon of podcasts. The vast majority of podcasts barely get anyone listening to them ever. And we had a lot of recognition.
Some people listening to this are like, you know, that resembles reality. It's true. Continue.
I mean, and it's hard to break through, but we managed to break through, to go viral a couple of times. And we never monetized the podcast, but I think that we could have, and we could have grown it. We ended up stopping it because I left and went to The Intercept. But the thing I will say about the internet is that it has a democratizing effect. My political career, to the extent that I have one, came fully out of engaging with people and having arguments and discussions on the internet, inviting people to continue those conversations on the podcast, writing articles that concretized my views and were able to be disseminated far and wide and went viral on their own kind of merit, not because I was a big name, not because I was associated with any institution. My most viral articles continue to come out of Current Affairs magazine. I've never been published in the New York Times, you know? And so I want to say, yes, it's hard, but it's not as hard as it would be if we didn't have the freedom of these internet platforms to get around a lot of the gatekeeping that has traditionally been done in this sector.
Again, this is why so many people want to be you. Really.
You're
saying yes, but awesome. I want to hear more horror stories in terms of corporate media mistreatment of the Bernie campaign.
You're going to get me in trouble. Look, you know, it was hard. It was hard largely because, you know, I know that everybody who works for every campaign, well, I think that a lot of people who work for a lot of campaigns really believe they're in it for the right reasons and because their candidate is the one that can truly help America. And so I don't mean to sound like Pollyanna about this.
No, I just want to interject for a moment, Bree. I cannot tell you how many times I did an event where there were tons of journalists present where I did what I thought was a good job and got zero mention.
You know, Andrew,
I know. Over and over again.
I will tell you that I told you this on our podcast, on Bad Faith Podcast, right? I remember being at The Intercept, and because I'm so online, I remember looking at YouTube videos. I would be watching Bernie YouTube videos and see people from the Yang Gang commenting in them, right? Like everywhere I looked on the internet, I saw Yang Gang, Yang Gang. And I was like, this feels like an organic phenomenon. This feels like something real and that's not going away. In the same way that I saw in a lot of YouTube comments and Twitter comments, people who were from California, who were from Kamala Harris's district, who were not big fans of her. And I said, well, this doesn't bode well for her campaign. I suspect that this is not going to go well. It was an early indication of the fire that you were able to ignite organically despite having no participation from the media. And I remember getting a request from your team to see if The Intercept had any interest in profiling you or interviewing you. And, you know, taking it to my editor and like asking what he thought. And there was a kind of, well, this isn't really going to go anywhere attitude. And I don't say that to like throw anybody under the bus. A lot of people don't go anywhere. And I was going off of like YouTube comments, and I could have very easily been wrong. But I can perceive that there's a certain kind of doomer pessimism about new people and new ideas among the left that can sometimes hurt candidates that could be really successful. AOC barely got any attention until she had that viral ad in like spring of 2018, right? So in your case, I think there were a lot of factors. I think that there's a hostility to new people, period. I think, if I can say this, there's a certain amount of, you know, racist bias, frankly. I think that...
You mean the Asian thing?
Yeah, I mean, like, they were, like, taking inches off of your height in articles. They were, like, shrinking
that,
you down.
That was a little
and
bit odd. The old, you know, the old incredible shrinking candidate. Like, huh, I didn't realize
it was ridiculous.
That
was... Look, we haven't had, a large number of examples of Americans of East Asian descent, like, taking politics by storm. That's not a reason for you to ignore it. It's a reason for you to celebrate firsts the way that you do when a lot of other firsts happen in this country. And it was really remarkable to me. You know, Pete Buttigieg being the first openly gay candidate to run is a big deal. But why wasn't your first status heralded more? We heard a lot about Kamala Harris's first status. You know, she's our first, you know, Asian American VP or will be, but you would have been our first Asian American president. And you can't pretend to care about these identity things, which are important, which I think matter on a certain level, but care selectively because you're obviously trying to boost certain people's interests versus another. And that's why I think there's so much cynicism about identity politics. And that's ultimately destructive to a lot of broader movements. But yeah, like I thought you instantly were exciting, largely because you were bringing a new idea to the table. New ideas to the table. People, you know, we all know that Bernie Sanders, you know, isn't popular because he was some like rhetorical dynamo and he was like wowing everybody with these Obama-like speeches. No, people were impressed with Bernie Sanders because he stood on a stage and said, hey, healthcare is a human right. I don't think that you should die just because you can't afford your insulin.
He has a very clear vision of values, principles, and goals.
Yes.
And it's very, very compelling, and it's unadulterated.
Yes.
You can tell it's not poll tested. You can tell he actually believes it.
Yes. You know, that's novel. And you have some of that too, Andrew. Like, people have a lot of respect for folks who are willing to stand behind an idea, especially one that's not test driven or poll, you know, poll vetted or whatever, and just sell it. And there's not enough of innovation. There's not enough of pitching that's done in the Democratic Party. There's too much poll testing and saying, well, let's like fit ourselves in the image of whatever this printed out sheet of paper tells us to be. Instead of having confidence and faith in the American people to be able to internalize, digest, and adopt a new idea.
I'm going to ask this just because I'm personally curious. Do you remember any conversations on the campaign about universal basic income and Bernie? Because I was waiting for him to say something positive about universal basic income, really the whole time, honestly. Do you remember any of those conversations? I'm just curious.
I don't. But I also wouldn't have really been privy to them in my role. I will say that in the discourse, in the lefty discourse, I've noticed there's the you know, jobs guarantee camp and the UBI camp, and there's some like tension between them. And there are a lot of people who are like, I don't really care, either or, both good ideas. And I think that what it felt like to me was that Bernie, with the jobs guarantee that was a part of the Green New Deal program, had just decided maybe for messaging clarity reasons, like, this is what we're going to do. It's a Green New Deal and jobs program, That's what we're going to do. But certainly now, in the context of COVID, when, you know, Bernie's been talking about $1,200, a lot of other people went 2000
like relief bill. Yeah.
Right. And has been since the beginning. Right. Meanwhile, yeah, and so has March. Kamala Harris, by the way, before she joined up with Joe Biden, she was championing $2,000 a month relief.
Yes.
But now that she's a part of this ticket, has been silent on it. And Joe Biden has also been silent on, wildly silent, and the media has not pressed him on this, on whether or not he supports cash relief. So I think that in a lot of ways, you won the messaging battle, even if it took this horrible tragedy to get us there.
I mean, I wish that we weren't in these circumstances that accelerated enthusiasm for universal basic income. It's interesting hearing your parallel set of experiences with the media, where it blew my mind many, many times, Bree, because like I'd be there, like you, I'd have a conversation with the journalist, and then you'd be like, oh, that was nice, and then you know, and then it'd be like you do something and it's like it didn't happen. And in my case, too, I'll share this, that when I did get press coverage, it was for things that had nothing to do with what I was campaigning on most of the time. It was for something very personality driven, like when I danced a Cupid Shuffle, like and then I showed up on the Sunday news programs that weekend. It was like me doing the Cupid Shuffle as like you know, Andrew Yang, like having a good time on the trail sort of thing. And I'm like, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's hard. It reminds me of this conversation that's going on right now, right, about whether or not the squad should use the fact that there is a really narrow margin for Democrats in the House to hold up Nancy Pelosi's floor vote, right? A very small number of progressives could say,
yes,
we're not
force
going
the
to
vote.
Make...
Let's talk about force the vote.
Force the vote. So they could make it so that Nancy Pelosi can't be Speaker of the House unless she concedes to certain demands. And what the main demand that's being pushed right now is that she have a floor vote on Medicare for All. And the idea being, not because there's a high likelihood that we would win, that the House would pass Medicare for All. There are only 118 co-sponsors in the House. Now, Democrats have a majority, and if every Democrat in the House voted for Medicare for All, we could pass Medicare for All. And I think we should reflect on what it means that all the House Democrats wouldn't pass Medicare for All in the middle of a global pandemic. That's a real, I think, indictment of our politics right now. But, you know, a lot of people are pushing back against the idea, saying, well, you're not going to win anyway, so what's the point? And it's all performative. Well, for a lot of us, especially on the left, if you don't do something that can grab attention, if you don't do something performative, if you don't do the Cupid Shuffle, if you don't figure out a way to marry the performative and the substantive, to say force the vote and let's hold up Nancy Pelosi's speakership, let's threaten Nancy Pelosi, who, you know, obviously politically, because she is one of the least liked, her favorabilities are worse than Trump. 3/4 of Americans think she should step down. Let's make her the center of the story. And also wed it with some substantive policy goals. Let's get Richard Neal out of the Ways and Means Committee because he's going to block Medicare for All. Let's get rid of PAYGO because that stands in the way of us being able to get all kinds of big ticket items that PAYGO requires you to fund them as you go along, and it makes it very difficult. We kind of put those things together because the average American doesn't want to hear a bunch of wonkery about PAYGO, but they might be interested in Nancy Pelosi, right? And vice versa. And you got to learn how to do a stunt, how to figure out how to exploit the system, which is, yes, very biased against the interest of the left, biased against the interest of working people.
I like the idea of forcing the vote. I mean, you know, like you should be able to vote on a policy that a lot of people support, and just, and if you're not for it, then you don't vote for it, and then we know, or you know. I mean, you know, it's like it shouldn't be that controversial in my mind.
Yeah, me either.
well, one thing I want to return to, because it speaks to this problem you're describing right now, and I think this is one of the core things. So you said earlier that a bunch of folks trust liberal media to report things with good intentions, and maybe they make a mistake every once in a while, but there's nothing sinister afoot. Now, the trust in media and the trust in institutions actually changes dramatically based upon your political alignment. So society-wide right now, trust in media is approximately 42%. If you say, hey, do you like trust national media to like report the news? Like 42%. Not great. That's not very good.
It's not great. It's better than Congress, though.
Yeah, yeah. Congress is like 15% or something like that.
Right.
So Re-election rate of 94%, though, so that's a real problem.
Exactly. Hashtag
that's something we can get into. Right. That's something we can get into, for sure. So 42% of people trust the media, but it actually varies wildly depending upon your politics. It turns out Republicans do not trust the media at all, more or less. You look at them, it's down to something like 24%. You look at independents, it's around 42%, whatever the national average is. Then you look at Democrats, it's in the 60s. It's maybe like 62%. So what's happening is you have Democrats who are among the last people to believe that the media is getting it right and that the liberal media, or as you'd call it, the corporate news sources, are getting it right. And so there's like this conversation that's being had that folks on either side are feeling somewhat excluded from. Like in your case, the progressives, like, hey, is this really what's going on? Like my guy just knocked it out of the park, the NAACP, like, you might want to report on that. You know, like, a lot of people like the idea of giving everyone healthcare, might want to get behind that and not treat everyone as loony. Who's for it? And then there are folks on the right who have a different perspective. Now I'm, you know, obviously more aligned with Democrats. But this institution, non-institution thing is actually, to me, one of the most powerful dynamics. And the media and the folks who trust the media and trust that our institutions are functioning comprise the majority of the Democratic Party. And then there is this subset that I think you are a part of that's starting to question a lot of that. And they're like independent news media sources. There's some independent voices. But it's difficult because there are a lot of folks who really do not want to question the institutional powers that be. And to me, the most powerful example of that, which really blew my mind, was before the election, when they couldn't come to terms on a relief bill. And Steve Mnuchin had like a $1.8 trillion offer that you referenced earlier. And then Nancy did not want that deal for a couple of reasons. And then I was looking around being like, why are people suggesting she should probably take this deal? Like, people are hurting. We can't wait through the winter. Like, let's just do this thing. And I said that, and there were so few people that were on board with my saying that.
Yeah, it was like you and Ro Khanna.
Yeah, it was me and Ro. Thank you, Ro Khanna, for not leaving me all alone on this one. But there were so many people that attacked me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to the club,
Andrew. Yeah, they attacked me. And I was like, look, I have my opinion on this negotiating stance. Yeah. Like, I think you should probably jump on this thing. You know, and you can disagree with me. You can say, hey, Andrew, I think you're wrong. Without it being some kind of like, you know, like a attack. And so there was this thing. There's this thing that happened, at least to me, and I think Bernie for sure. But there was like this institutional resistance to someone questioning Nancy Pelosi's process or judgment. And it shocked me that there weren't more people that were questioning it at that point.
You know, my friend, at every stage, this is what we're faced with. Look, I expect that you probably got some people accusing you of secretly trying to support Trump, or why do you hate the Democratic Party so much? You might as well go be a Republican. I mean, that's the kind of response that I get if I say anything mildly critical of a choice made by a Democrat.
In my case, I was actually accused of sexism. That was
there you go. That's line of attack. There's another one that happens. Look, obviously sexism is real and true in the world, but it can't be. This is, again, the cynicism around identity politics. Identity matters. People have been marginalized on the basis of their identity, both socially and de jure, like legally. Our government until 50 years ago was doing this. Identity matters as a political metric. However, identity cannot be cynically used by the party apparatus in order to deflect substantive criticism in the way that's being done repeatedly. And that cynicism around identity is driving people to the right, is driving people into the arms of right wingers that we, in the, you know, neo-fascist populist uprising that created Trump, in a way that we don't want to happen. We need to be honest about what's going on and be willing to accept criticism. So I think that you were right about that. I think that a lot of people now that we see the deal that we got are understanding that a choice was made explicitly because Nancy Pelosi didn't want to give Donald Trump points, anything that he could campaign over before the election. Now, that raises a lot of other questions for me. Why was the election so close if Donald Trump was so vile? Right? Why was the election so close that the idea of letting him put out a stimulus check with his name on it could have thrown, maybe, we don't even know that that's true, but maybe could have advantaged him meaningfully in the election? Why wasn't the Democratic Party, long before we got that close to the general election, running explicitly on cash payments to Americans? Why wasn't there an arms race?
Favored by 88% of voters. Yep. I don't know what the other 12% are thinking. 88's pretty high.
Yes. By the way, you know what else 88% of voters support? Medicare for all. 88% of voters support. No, sorry. 88% of Democrats support Medicare for all. 72% of voters, according to a Fox News exit poll. A Fox News exit poll showed that 72% of Americans overall support Medicare for all. And about 50% of Republicans do. So why is it that Joe Biden is in the context of the general election saying, I would veto Medicare for all, even if it passed the House and the Senate? Why aren't we asking the questions about why the Democrats aren't running on these enormously popular beneficial policies that can make the election not so close that we had to deny Americans much needed economic support at a national low point in terms of both the economy and our national health?
The lack of stimulus between April and December was
morally
criminal.
Yes.
Looking at that objectively, be like, and if you withheld for political reasons, that's awful. And, you know, you can't know whether that was the motivation, but certainly it felt a whole lot like that.
It was made explicit at one point that, you know, this could help Trump. Like, that was an explicit message. I don't remember at this point, don't quote me, that it came out of Pelosi's mouth or somebody else in Democratic Party leadership. But that wasn't a creation of the media. That wasn't just conjecture. That was the message. And Democrats, you know, a lot of Democrats who trust the party bought into that and said, well, yes, the most important thing is defeating Donald Trump. Therefore, even if it hurts millions of Americans, we're going to keep the stimulus in the bag. And, you know, that's why I'm saying again, like, it should never have been that close. Whether or not it helps Donald Trump was only an issue because I believe the party leadership in the chosen candidate didn't do enough to distinguish themselves from Trump and fight affirmatively for what they were going to do for America. Instead, it was a I'm not Trump, let's defeat Trump sort of campaign. And that just doesn't galvanize people the way that cash relief, Medicare for all, canceling student debt, legalizing marijuana, UBI mobilizes people.
So Bree, now that, and I remember the spring very well, and I know it was deeply painful for everyone on the Bernie campaign, where it felt like it was this close, like right there post Nevada, and then Jim Clyburn endorses Joe in South Carolina, and then the entire tide turns and all the candidates head a particular direction. So it's been 7-8 months since then. You've now pivoted to become an independent voice, a journalist. Producing things that you believe in. What do you see as like the next number of steps for progressives, for trying to make some of these changes happen politically, for yourself individually? You've had like a fascinating career already and you're still just getting started. But like I look up and, you know, there are times when I'm very optimistic. There are times when I think that the mechanics of our system are just desperately broken when you start digging into some of these numbers, like, an 18% approval rating for Congress and a 94% reelection rate, you're like, whoa, like, how does that work? And then you start looking at mechanical fixes. One mechanical fix I've been pushing very hard is ranked choice voting.
Absolutely.
And open primaries, which I think would make our politics much more dynamic and responsive and genuine. And
yes.
Then you couldn't bully everyone being like, you're going to waste your vote. You're going to like elect the evil or whatever. Yes. It's like, well, if you're ranked choice voting, we don't need to worry about it anymore. So let's pursue
Absolutely.
True democratic reforms.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan, a huge advocate of ranked choice voting. The number one bully pulpit, to your point, that the Democratic Party has is if you don't vote for the lesser of two evils, you're going to make the evil win. And we have been operating on that logic since, you know, realignment and the Democratic Party became what it is today. And the Republican Party became the you know, Southern Strategy Party of white racism that, you know, it emerged as. And we've been trying to struggle out of that since the 1960s, since the 1950s. And I raised this question, you know, at this point kind of infamously on our podcast in an episode with Noam Chomsky, where I simply asked, look, let's assume that Donald Trump presents a unique evil and we all have to vote him out this time. What do we do between now and 2024 to make sure we're not in this same situation? How do we get out of this lesser of two evilism structure? And if we are willing to pledge our votes to the Democratic Party, no matter what, under any circumstances, I thought Michael Bloomberg was a closer call in terms of who was worse with respect to Donald Trump, because he's a lot more capable and had actually enacted a much more extreme racial pogrom in New York City than Donald Trump managed, although he certainly tried, because Michael Bloomberg isn't incompetent, unlike Donald Trump. And people were, you know, willing to vote for him. You know, there were Donnie Joyce, people were saying they wouldn't vote for Bernie, but they would vote for Bloomberg if he was the eventual nominee. So what authority do we have? What line in the sand is there? If Democrats are never willing to say enough is enough, this is not the kind of candidate we want representing us, this is not the kind of party we are. Is there any policy that they won't throw under the bus? Is there any kind of candidate that we won't accept? And if the answer is no, we should expect that the party moves more and more and more to the right over the course of history, the way it's been doing. So what's going to stop that movement? I think that ranked choice voting is one of those things. I think greater union participation and figuring out how to organize massive blocks of voters that can meaningfully, incredibly threaten Democrats to say, we are going to withhold our vote. We are not going to mobilize our population unless you adhere to some basic standards, like the fact that 88% of Democrats want Medicare for all, but barely half of the House of Representatives will co-sponsor the bill. What? That, like, the idea, people are arguing against force the vote, who are like, well, it wouldn't pass anyway. That's not an indictment of the idea of force the vote. That's a colossal indictment of elected representatives, Democratic representatives in the House. We are in the middle of a global pandemic where 15 million people have just lost their employer-based health care. All of the people who are arguing, if you like your health care, you can keep it during the primary election, should be put on the mat by a journalist every single day asking, have you revised your position? Do you want to apologize for misleading the public and spreading right-wing talking points? Because none of that was true. And now you have to answer to 15 million Americans, 15 million, who in the middle of a global health crisis have no recourse with respect to paying for their health care. That's unconscionable. And yet we don't have a media apparatus who's willing to do that. And for people like you and those on the left who are willing to stand up and articulate some, you know, break from consensus, are ridiculed, called traitors to the party, accused of sexism or some other kind of identity-based bias. And there's no real reckoning at any point. So I do think that, yes, ranked choice voting needs to be pushed. Democrats will never do it because that's the source, one of the main sources of their power. But we have to agitate for it. We need to start going to town halls. Take a lesson out of the Tea Party's playbook, which was a lesson out of Saul Alinsky's playbook on the left, and make life uncomfortable for our elected representatives until they start actually representing us. And that goes for some of the people who have been progressive champions as well. It's not about throwing them out or saying they're terrible people or questioning their motives, but it's about understanding that there is a such thing as institutional creep. When you are in office, your motives start to change and you have an incentive in maintaining your status and your position. And you have all of these incentives to raise money and give money to the party so that you can get hierarchy and status within your committee positions and all of these kinds of things, which are important, but shouldn't come at the expense of the people that you were elected to represent. We need to give money to independent candidates so that they can rely on the people and be beholden to the people instead of being beholden to corporate interests. We need to push for campaign finance reform so they don't have the option to be dependent on corporate interests. And we all just have to stay a lot more engaged and have confidence, have faith, keep the faith that if we do these things and we stand together and we recognize that it's not left-right, that it is top-down, and then the 99% stands together, it is possible for us to have a better world. It is possible, and we should not let pessimism cow us.
Oh, you're like the antidote to cynicism. I love it. Anyone who needs a reminder of the fact that we can do great things. Bree's got a podcast every week with Virgil, Virgil's more of a downer than Bree. So you
guys should know. Yes, we play a little bit of a yin-yang. Good cop, bad cop situation.
You're a very good team. So for you personally, I'm sure there was like a sense of depletion after the campaign, and then you've just gotten kind of your legs underneath you in terms of this new podcast and your new independent media project. Would the plan be to just keep on building your voice and work until like the next candidate catches fire and manages to get your attention?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I'm interested to see what happens electorally, but I'm also really interested to start to explore non-electoral activism. You know, there's been a little bit of a circular firing squad on the left this past week or two about Force the Vote. And to try to break out of that, I'm reaching out to union leaders and organizers to try to come on and give us a more concrete sense of how change happens. You know, a lot of left pundits like to say, well, your idea doesn't work because it really requires organizing and it requires grassroots support. I mean, like, that's great, but don't we play a role in helping to germinate that?
Can't we do that? Why not?
Right. Like, I'm not doing anything else. I'm just a podcaster. Let me call up the head of my local DSA. Let me write to my representative and see if she can get on the record on Force the Vote. You know, let me reach out to the Medicare for All advocates. Let me reach out to Black Lives Matter advocates. Let's see, what does it actually take to get 3,000 people standing in front of the Capitol? What does it take to organize a million person march or the women's march? Let me ask you know, some
can
of the people in the campaign
not do
who
anything?
Did that.
This woman can do anything. She does name. It's beautiful.
Well, I haven't done it yet.
One thing I
want to.
Oh, you will do. all of those things are very doable. One thing I want to just insert into this Force the Vote conversation, and this is something that a member of Congress informed me of, that I was like, wow, that's freaking terrible. It's very hard to get any vote going on the floor because of something called the Denny Hastert rule, where you need the majority of the majority party to be on board to even introduce anything.
Yes.
So I want you all to imagine being first, let's say, a minority legislator. So let's say you're a Democrat in the Senate or Republican in the House. You're like, well, I can't force a vote on a single thing because we're not a majority of the majority. And then I want you to imagine being a minority of the majority party where you also can't get a vote on anything because, you know, like you don't have, I suppose it would be, you know, like 130 or 140 colleagues on board or whatever the number is. So that rule just strikes me as so terrible. Like it just seems like such a dysfunctional body where it's literally like if you have the majority of the majority, then you can actually advance things. And if you don't, you can't. And then you can just chill out. So
it incentivizes an action, which is why this opportunity, right? Because the speaker can bring a floor vote. The speaker, regardless of the numbers you've got, can bring a floor vote.
Well, and the speaker is the one that enacted this rule. That's not even a rule. It's like, you know, it's like the speaker saying, well, I'm not going to do it unless the majority. So they clearly can do what they want.
Yeah.
Go ahead, it's
aggregating party for herself, a power rather for herself. All of it, so much of what we see in politics is that people get a little bit of power and they hoard it. You know, even, you know, we talked a lot about George Bush's overreach and expansion of executive power. And then Barack Obama came into office and instead of dismantling it, once you get there, you're like, well, I'm the good guy. So it's good if I have power. So let me keep what was aggregated for me in the last administration and then get a little bit of more. And so what we get is increasingly individuals who are able to lord their preferences in a very anti-democratic way over the rest of us.
Which I'm going to suggest is particularly problematic when you're looking at a legislative body of hundreds of people. like that to me is like more problematic even. I mean, the executive abuses have their own, you know, like separate category of problem. But I feel like in a legislative body, like hoarding it at that level just seems particularly egregious, at least to me.
Yeah, I mean, they're literally, especially the House, that kind of representative body, the most representative body that we have, basically being frozen in inaction. You know, and this idea that, you know, to your point about Republicans not being able to bring something to a floor vote too, look what's happening right now. Who's fighting for cash relief? It's a independent and a Republican, you know, who are leading the charge. Bernie, you know, so
it was in the Senate. It was Bernie Sanders and Josh Hawley.
Exactly.
And then there were some folks working it behind the scenes, including Cory Booker. And then I know this because I've been actually working this scene for a while. Like I've been having calls and sessions about cash relief. Mm. And then in the house, I'm happy to say that dozens of members on both sides of the aisle got on board with cash relief. Mm-hmm. And so there was like this four corners negotiation around the stimulus bill. If you remember, the bipartisan Senate bill that got proposed in the beginning of December didn't include cash relief. Mm. And we had like a freak out here. I had a freak out. I was like, how can there not be cash relief in this thing? But we'd been trying to get folks excited about cash as part of this bill for weeks. And so I'm just going to call out a few people, some of whom you know and love, but Lisa Blunt Rochester and David McKinley were the bipartisan sponsors of a cash relief bill in the House. Mm. And then I'm happy to say that like people from all over the political map, from Pramila Jayapal to Tom Reed to others. And one of the rules we had on that bill was that we want a Republican for every Democrat. And we got it. Like, so it just like it grew. It was like Noah's Ark. It was wild. But so you should know that that was happening in the House. The House, I think, was more stridently for cash relief. In the Senate, it blew my mind that after Bernie and Josh Hawley came out and were like, hey, we should really have stimulus, which they were totally right. And I was working like senators being like, you want to get in on that? Because they're right. And like, you know, like everyone agrees with it. And so it was odd that we couldn't get more senators on the record for cash relief. There were three that were for it behind the scenes. Anyway, sorry, just wanted to let you know about what's going on.
That's really useful. And I think that part of it is that they're not as, senators aren't as accountable. You know, they have longer terms. Their races tend to be more expensive. You know, I think they can, in a lot of ways, be less accountable to their constituents. Plus, to the earlier point about media bias, I don't know if you saw the clip where Bernie Sanders, you know, went on MSNBC to talk about cash relief, and he was pressed by, I believe it was Stephanie Ruhle. She said, well, I'm looking at a sheet of paper here, Bernie. She had a graphic all ready to go that says you've only passed whatever, a handful of bills in your entire time in Congress. Don't you think you should take a different approach? So she completely took the conversation off of this relief bill and millions of Americans who desperately need it to try to give some dig about how she doesn't think that Bernie Sanders has done enough while he is in Congress. And like, that's the kind of crap you get. And people get away with it. People get away with it.
I mean, I certainly have an axe to grind with MSNBC. I don't know if you, I don't know if you were apprised of the entire like
yeah, I mean,
dynamic over there.
I saw it happening. I saw you know, all the little stuff not cutting to you during the debates. You know, like it was apparent to me. You know, it was apparent to me what was happening to you, what was happening to Marianne Williamson. You know, for like a second there, like Bill de Blasio, like I had my eyes open. And I don't think it behooves us, even if it were to like advantage my candidate, I don't think it behooves us in the long term for us to ignore those things, because it hurt every candidate at a certain point, right? There was a point at which Cory Booker and Julian Castro both raised concerns about whether or not Joe Biden had the stamina to be president. And in the spin room, they were kind of immediately shut down. The coverage of Julian Castro asking that question during the debate of like, did you just, you know, forget what you just said, was really pilloried. Even though if you listen back to the tape, he was completely right. You can disagree with his tone or something, but he was accurate in his assessment of what had just happened on the stage. And then the mild, you know, Cory Booker is so polite. He gave a really soft, mild, you know, like, I'm just concerned, like it's something that we should consider. You never heard a peep out of them ever again. The back, it was like a hard shutdown. We're not going to talk about Joe Biden's, you know, stamina, anything cognitive. And we're going to push forward like this never happened. And then the idea that anyone would question whether Joe Biden's, you know, little peccadillos here and there were a part of or an indication of something bigger that was going on. It was spun as this is a left wing attack. I'm like, you know, Cory Booker is not exactly what I would call left wing. He seems like a lovely man, but this is not exactly what I would call a part of the left vanguard, you know? And so this kind of stuff adds up, and it doesn't help people not to have conversations that are gonna emerge in the general, because Donald Trump isn't playing by those rules, vetted in a primary when we can still do something about it.
this is something that's come out recently about Dianne Feinstein.
Yes. Feinstein. Yes.
The average age of a U.S. senator is 62, and that's average. So, you know, and to me, age is just a number, but there are, like, some folks that, like, are feeling their age and others that are less so. And so, you know, if there is some kind of way to verify when, I mean, I certainly think Trump's been freaking deteriorating before our eyes for, like, the last number of years. This to me is actually something that the media should be considered, like, really much more responsible for, that we are not. It's like we have leaders who would not be considered for leadership positions in other industries based upon their age, and then in the public sector, it's like a taboo subject to raise in various ways.
Yeah, not just age. Like, you know, obviously I supported a very old candidate, you know, and, you know, as much as I felt like it was biased and sometimes not constructive, I'm not going to be mad at anyone for having a conversation about, you know, does Bernie have the stamina after a heart attack? Like, that's a legitimate conversation to have. But the bias, the unwillingness to have that conversation about Joe Biden, you know, the unwillingness to have a conversation, you know, in light of specific instances of him misspeaking or getting facts wrong or having an emotional outburst at a reporter, listen fat, pushing people, you know, like, this stuff is fair game if it's going to be fair game about other candidates. And the idea that it could be spun into a left-wing attack, it boggles the mind.
Yeah, that should be, there should just be a standard.
just be even Stevens. That's all I ask.
Yeah. Wow, this is so much fun. I can't believe the time has flown by. We should do this every week, Bree. I'm going to urge you to replace Virgil with me.
let's start a podcast. LOL. At that point, I would have to, like, answer for why I only do podcasts with Asian American men.
I hadn't even thought of that.
It would be 3 for 3 for me. And I'd have to see it by shrink or something about it.
I didn't know pre-Virgil there was another.
No, my first.
Oh, wait,
you
told me.
Yeah, someone's Korean. Wrong on the internet. Yes. That's right.
Wow. No wonder, you know, I this feels so familiar. But incredibly grateful to you, really, and learned a lot. You are such a positive voice of both reason and progress. I appreciate the heck out of you. If there's anything I can do to help, let me know. And certainly let Virgil know that if he needs me to pinch hit for him anytime, like, I can just sort of show up unannounced.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate you too so much, Andrew. You're a clarion voice, and I appreciate your willingness to kind of go against the grain. And I really look forward to whatever is up your sleeve next as well.
Thank you, Bree. So much fun. Have a great holiday season.
You too. Stay safe.